terms of tzedakah and organizations to give to. And I heard an idea that Kirub would be at the top of the list because it's it has an element or to whatever degree of either Pekuach Nefesh or Pinyan Shavuah, something to that effect.
Well, that sounds like an advertising for a Kirub organization. The Shulchan Aruch on the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch follows the one does give certain levels of kedima. For example, the aniyim of Eretz Yisrael have kedima over chutz l'aretz. On the other hand, the aniyim of your own city are kind of equal to the aniyim of Eretz Yisrael. So if I'm given, if I live, let's say, in Maryland, and I am given requests for yeshivos in New York versus yeshivos in Maryland, the Maryland yeshivos have priority, but the Eretz Yisrael yeshivos would be equal to the Maryland yeshivos, and you divide it up that way. Food is more important than clothing, etc. But once you talk about, let's say, kiruv versus hachnasas kala, or you're talking about helping aniyim versus yeshivos, there, what's very interesting is we don't really have a system of kedima, meaning to say, Chazal understood, the Torah understands, that each person's neshama is connected to different types of causes. Now, kiruv is a very important cause because you're correct, you're bringing people back to Hashem, and since Chazal say, when you cause somebody to sin, it is equivalent to killing him. Gadol hamachtiyo yoser min ahorga, to cause someone to sin is greater than killing him. So the reverse of that is that saving somebody from sin is a form of giving him life. Right? If sinning is equal to death, then achzara b'tshuva is equal to pikuach nefesh, and there is such a svara. But as I say, it's impossible to say that that would necessarily replace other tzedakas. For example, there's a fellow, I see his name in every sefer, that gives huge amounts of money to have Svarim printed, have Shasas printed, Shulchan Aruch printed, and the like. Now you could say, well, why are you giving all that money for Svarim? You can give money to poor people and live people who would make it. But the answer is, if Klal Yisrael needs that, that's also a legitimate need. So my short answer, which is not just a great answer, is that there is no halachic priority. But like many, many mitzvahs, a person has to choose where they feel that they can do the most good. And kirub is certainly a very, very important cause, but there are other important causes as well. People ask a shayla, for example. Let's say somebody has, a lot of money. Someone has $100,000, and they want to support a kollel for a year. So should they take a kollel of people who have been learning for many years, who are big talmidei chachamim? In other words, do you put your money for the biggest Talmud Chacham? Or do you put your money for people who are relative beginners because that's going to bring them to the level of being a Talmud Chacham? Now, it all depends how you measure it, right? If I want to measure my money in terms of block that is covered and in terms of depth that is achieved, I would want to go with the more experienced Talmudei Chachamim. If, on the other hand, I want to create new Talmudei Chachamim in the world, then I would go with the Kirov Kolam. Now, which is more important? Again, it goes back to that answer. What is more important, the heart or the brain? I mean, the answer is you can't live without both of them. We need Eifanim to bring Jews to Torah, and we need Talmidei Chachamim, who are great in Torah, to support Klal Yisrael. So consequently, each person, Mashaligo Chavex, is supposed to gravitate to the cause that is dear to their heart. Which means in Stucca, there's a great, great deal of subjectivity in terms of where you want to put your resources. But having said that, I agree that your description of kirub is an accurate description. That would be an important one. But to tell me how logically it's pidyon shvuyah, that is probably not the case.
How did the Hebrews know to listen to Moses when he came to take the Jews out of Egypt? I understand that at Mount Sinai, when they were all being spoken to, God told Moses so that everyone could hear something like, they will believe in you forever.
Yeah.
But that's after they were already over. How did the Jews in Egypt know to listen to
Moses? Well, first of all, if you remember in Parsha Shmos, there were signs that Moshe did, not only to Paro, not only from the Paro, but to the Zikne Yisrael, to the elders of Israel, in order to convince them. He turned the staff into a snake. His hand was leprous. Saras. Remember, if you look in the Chumash, you see very clear that the purpose of those signs was not just to convince Paro, but it was to convince the Jewish people. Now, there's another Medrash, and here you're going to have a question of circularity, that before Yosef died, Yosef says at the end of Parshas Vayechi, Pakod Yifkod Elokim Eschem. God, Pakod, God will surely remember you. V'halisem es atzmosayim yizeh itchem, and you will take my bones from Egypt and bring them back to Eretz Israel. Right? This is what Yosef said. So the Zakenim had like almost a secret code that the Redeemer of Israel will come with the double words, Pakod Yifkod, God has remembered. And Moshe Rabbeinu used that lashon of Pakod Yifkod, and that was kind of apparently an unknown code. It wasn't known by everybody, but the Zikne Israel, the elders of Israel, knew that he who comes with those words was sent by Hashem to be the Redeemer. Now the question is, how did they know that Moshe didn't know? I mean, Moshe had lived in Mitzrayim for many years, right? Maybe Moshe knew those words, and therefore he used it, and it's not a proof he was told by Hashem. But the assumption was that this apparently was a secret, and it was known to the Zakenim, who had access to the secret, who did not have access to the secret. And the person who uses that code, by definition, was given that message from Hashem. So it's the double Pakod Yifkod Elokim Eschem.
We know that if Torah learning was to stop even a second, the world would be destroyed. So what was sustaining the world before Matan Torah?
Yes, it's very excellent. Do you know, in Tehillim, Kuf Chafav, which we say every Shabbos, and we also say at the Pesach Seder, that's Hodu Hashem Ki Tov Kili Olam Chasto, Hodu Hashem, a whole bunch of Kili Olam Chastos. There are 26 statements, Hashem's loving kindness is forever. The Gemara says, that is a remez that there were 26 generations before Matan Torah, and the only reason the world existed was the chesed of Hashem. There was no real reason for that world to exist, because even with and this is in spite of the others, in spite of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the great, great tzaddikim, but until the Torah, the world had no intrinsic justification. And that's why Kili Olam Chazdu is repeated 26 times. Right? There are 26 generations from Adam HaRishon to Matan Torah, if you count from Adam, Sheis, Noah, etc. So, Enochinami, the world existed on pure chesed at that point. Credit, Hashem, as it were, gave credit to the world based on what would happen in the future. By the way, just Terach Agav, just a little aside, not relevant directly to your question, but it is very fascinating. There's a very, very interesting Maharal. The Maharal raises a question that many, many Mefarshim ask. That is, we do have a Masorah that the Avos kept the whole Torah even before it was given. And even before Matan Torah, the Avos kept all of the mitzvahs. So the question becomes, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? Yaakov married Rachel. Now, granted, for a Noahide, there's no prohibition of two sisters, but nevertheless, Yaakov kept the whole Torah, so Yaakov shouldn't have married two sisters. So the Ramban gives an answer, that the only time the Avos kept the whole Torah is when they lived in Eretz Yisrael. And since Yaakov married Rachel and Leah when he lived in Padan Aram, so he did not have to keep the whole Torah, or even on his own, did not keep the whole Torah. And that's actually why Rachel dies as soon as he comes to Eretz Yisrael, because in Eretz Yisrael, the Avos kept the whole Torah. But the Maharal says, oh yeah, another answer that's given is that Rachel and Leah have a din of converts because they repudiated the idolatry of Laban's house to become Jews. And when two people convert, they are like newly born babies who have no relationship to each other. In fact, Doraisa, this is amazing, this is Doraisa, Rabbanim Nitzasser, so don't quote me as legitimating incest. But the Doraisa, if a father and a daughter convert, they are allowed to get married. Doraisa, if a mother and a son convert, they're allowed to get married. Doraisa, if a brother and sister convert, Doraisa, they are allowed to get married. Similarly, if two sisters convert, when polygamy was allowed, I would be allowed to marry two sisters, because halachically they're not sisters. So that's the second answer. But the Maharal gives a third answer that's very interesting, that when we say the Avos kept the whole Torah, it means they kept the positive commandments, like putting on tefillin and the like. The negative commandments they did not feel a need to keep. What's the difference? The difference is a positive commandment adds holiness to your soul. So even if they weren't commanded, they wanted to do positive mitzvos to get the holiness in their neshama. But a negative commandment, the Maharal says, does not make you holier. Rather, violating a negative makes you more profane. In other words, let's say, for example, you start off the day when you open your eyes, I'm just going to make up a number, with 10 units of Kedusha. Now, if in the course of the day I daven, I learn, I say Kriya Shema, right, so I can go from 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 to 100. But let's say all I did today was I didn't kill, I didn't steal, I didn't commit the sin of adultery. Well, that's not going to bring me from a 10 to a 20. If I would kill, if I would commit adultery, it would be like a hole in me in which the Kedusha is draining out. In other words, negative commandments, their violation takes away your Kedusha, but their fulfillment just keeps you at the status quo. And the Maharal argues, if the only thing a negative commandment does is take away your Kedusha, that's only because you're rebelling against God. So if Hashem didn't command you to keep the negative, and it's only on a voluntary basis, it's not going to hurt you. It's not going to be like poison to you and the like. Therefore, the Avos felt no obligation to keep negative commandments unless they were so commanded by God, which they were not. The Maharal uses this to answer an amazing question of Taisus, because we know, and unfortunately you probably have experienced this, that when you're in a cemetery, within Tzmor and Brachos, within four amos of a mace, you're not allowed to have your tzitzis out, you're not allowed to wear tefillin, and you're not supposed to learn Torah. Now, you are allowed to say Tehillim and Davin because that's in honor of the mace, but you're not allowed to stam zayla. I want to learn in front of the mace. And the reason why you don't do that is because a pasuk in Mishlei talks about mocking a poor man. That's called loeg l'rush. You're making fun. Why? Because when the person was alive, they could do mitzvahs. And now that they're dead, they cannot do mitzvahs. And the neshama is aware of what you're doing. And the neshama sees you or feels that you're doing mitzvahs that it can't do. The neshama has pain and humiliation and tsar. Therefore, you must distance yourself from the neshama. Now, does the neshama only see four amas? I'm not sure why four amas is so good, but at least you don't do it right in front of the neshama. This is a Gemara in Brachos. Taisus's kasha is the following. You know, we bury a mace in tachrichim. Tachrichim are burial shrouds. And our minog is they're pure linen. But the Gemara discusses, are you allowed to bury a mace in shatnas? Let's say you have burial shrouds that were made of wool and linen. I'm not allowed to wear shatnas, right? Can I put shatnas on a dead body? So the Gemara says, it depends on a machlokas. Are mitzvahs going to take effect after resurrection of the dead? If the mitzvahs are going to take effect after resurrection of the dead, you cannot put shatnas on a dead body, because when he comes back with resurrection, he'll be wearing shatnas. So you're causing him to sin later. Although they might disintegrate with that, but since we don't know when the resurrection is, so there's a chance he'll come back very soon, so you can't do it. If, on the other hand, the Gemara says, mitzvahs are not going to kick in with Tchias HaMesim, nothing wrong with him, because he's not going to be sinning. But Tosos asks the kasha, even if the mitzvah is not going to come back, but aren't you making fun of him? Because it's the same way, loeg l'rush. Loeg l'rush means don't make fun of a poor person. I mean, the same way, I don't put on tzitzis, or I don't show my tzitzis, I don't wear tefillin, I don't daven, because I'm making fun of him. I don't put shatnas on him, because that would be making fun of him. So the Maharal, this is Tosfos' kasha, very, very good kasha. So the Maharal answers that loeg l'rush is only shayach by a mitzvah saseh, because since a mitzvah saseh gives me extra holiness, and he doesn't have the chance to achieve that holiness, he is mocked. But a negative commandment doesn't give me holiness, it simply takes away the holiness I have. The mace doesn't lose anything. If he died at a 10, he stays at a 10. Because since he doesn't have that negative iser, there is nothing wrong that's happening to him by the shotness on him. So that's what the Maharal says. That answers Taisus's kasha. Now, the reason I bring this up, although it's really irrelevant to your question, is that in a sense, maybe that's a partial answer, a little bit of an answer, because even before Matan Torah, the Agos HaKadoshim and the Shvatim also kept the Torah and learned Torah. So you did have a Zechus of Torah even then, but that's only a partial answer, because what about the 10 generations between Noach and Abraham, where you didn't have people keeping the mitzvahs and the like? But just to keep in mind, though, there was a chelik of Torah that existed prior to Matan Torah as well. You have any details?
I heard with the Ramah and the Machaber that the Machaber obviously took the three Gedolim at the time, and the Ramah obviously where Minhagim differed and whatnot is where he wrote the Haggos. But I've also heard that the Ramah took the later generation and factored that into his Pesach as well, rather than just finding differences in Minhagim. Just to restate that, so it's good.
First of all, just to be sure everyone knows, is on the same page. First of all, everyone knows Lag BaOmer was the yard site of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, although maybe it isn't. Some have actually said that the idea that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai died in Lag BaOmer was based on a mistake in deciphering a manuscript of the Talmidim of the Ari. The Talmidim of the Ari wrote down that there's a great simcha in Lag BaOmer, because that is the day that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai revealed his Torah. And it says, Uvayom Hazeh Samach Bo, Samach. On that day, he rejoiced. A later manuscript read Samach as if it said Shemes. Think about a Ches and a Tuf. They could be very similar. And they erroneously read the Ches to be a Suf, especially in Rashi scripts. It's very close. So some have actually questioned the whole Hanacha, whether he died in Lag BaOmer. But the one person who did die in Lag BaOmer was the Ramah. The Ramah's yard site is, in fact, on Lag BaOmer. The Ramah is buried in Krakow, Poland, next to his shul. The shul, there's the base Knesset of the Ramah that's still there. If you go to that base Knesset, number one, it's the only shul in Krakow that regularly still has a minyan. I mean, they dive in there, besides visitors, but there are minyanim in Krakow. And the Ramah's makom is still there. Ramah's seat is exactly like he left it. The seat is there. It's cordoned off, so you shouldn't inadvertently sit in the Ramah's makom. And even Hasidim, a lot of the main religious visitors to Poland are Hasidim. They go to different kvarim. And when they go to the Ramah's shul, they daven Ashkenaz, not Sfar. You know Hasidim daven Sfar because they say, in the Ramah's shul, we have to do what the Ramah does. I want to say that they're better than us, because when we go to the Rav Yosef Karo shul in Svat, we daven Ashkenaz every time. We're not following that example there. Okay. One can say, Rav Yosef Karo shul, daven Svat. Okay. But, so as you know, the Ramah wrote the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo wrote a Shulchan Aruch, and then the Ramah wrote the Ashkenazic additions to the Shulchan Aruch, and Svardim generally passing like Rav Yosef Karo, the Machader, and Ashkenazim follow the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, and the Ramah is the one in Rashi scripts, and the like. Now, the Shulchan Aruch is really an abridgment. It's a summary of a much, much larger work that Rav Yosef Karo wrote, which is really the more important sefer, and that is the Beis Yosef. The predecessor to the Shulchan Aruch was the Tur, and the Beis Yosef is on the Tur, and he gives you a compilation of all of the shitas of the Rishonim, starting from the Gemara and Rashi and Tosos and Rambam, etc., and then he comes up with a decision. And the Shulchan Aruch is nothing more than the final summary of all of the decisions that are reached in the Beis Yosef. That's why anyone who really, really, really wants to become proficient in halakha doesn't just learn the Shulchan Aruch or even the Mishnah Berurah, but you go back to the Torah and the Beis Yosef. And that really gets you the background from the Gemara. Now, what was the methodology? I know you said this. What was the methodology that Rabbi Yosef Karo used in deciding the halacha? So he decided, and it's interesting what gave him the right to make that decision, but he decided that even though there were many, many, many poskim, many, many, that he would look at three main poskim, and he would decide the halacha based on a 2-to-1 vote on any given issue. And the three main poskim that he chose was the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush, Rabbeinu Usher, that's in the back of the Gemara. And he would say, in any matter of halacha, that two out of the three were machriya. Now, just to give you a sense of, look who he ignored, at least in this formula. I mean, think about other names. He ignored, for example, the Rashba. And now when I say ignored, I don't mean he ignored him. I mean, the Beis Yosef brings the Rashba all the time, but he just means that they were not in the voting process. He ignored the Ramban. He ignored the Ritva. He ignored the Trumas Hadeshim. Meaning, he just took those three, which he considered to be the greatest, and he was machriya the halacha based on two out of three. Now, first of all, that stacks the deck automatically, and the reason is the following. The Rush is almost always going to be the odd man out, because the Rif was first, right? The Rif was actually the first Rishon who codified halacha, right? The Rif is in the back of every Gemara, and if you know the way the Rif is written, the Rif is written in the order of the Gemara. The Rif is essentially an abridgment of the Gemara. So if the Gemara has a machlokas and has a shakla vitaria and it goes through, so the Rif will take out the shakla vitaria and will say something like, here we have a machlokas and the maskana is this. That's the Rif. In fact, the Rif is actually a very good way to chazer a masechta quickly. It used to be done in Europe that after you learned the Gemara, you would learn the Rif. The Rif only codifies halakha that's megebas manazes, so there's no Rif on korbanos or kachin or anything like that. Now, the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, which is a new topical arrangement, the Rambam follows the Rif 95% of the time. It is very rare that the Rambam is cholek on the Rif. The Rif is the foundation of the Rambam. Now, the Rush, however, is often independent, because the Rush represents, from France and Germany, the Balei HaTosfos, Rashi, Tosfos, and the like. That's why the Rush is Ashkenazic, and the Rambam and the Rif are Sephardic, because the Rambam was Egypt and the Rif was Morocco, North Africa. So to have a rule that Rav Yosef of Cairo says, I will go with two out of three, basically means the Rambam always wins, because the Rambam and the Rif are always together, and the Rush, when he's cholek, is always the odd man out. So that is why Ashkenazic custom was ignored. You see why? Because two out of the three that the Beis Yosef chose were Sephardic, and those two are almost always the same. Now, because of this, the Rama, who lived in Poland was already Ashkenaz, Germany, Poland, Russia, felt there was a need to incorporate the viewpoint not only of the Rush, but of the Balei HaTosfos, of which the Rush was a part, but all the Balei HaTosfos, and all of the many poskim in Germany, and in Poland, and in parts of Russia, because number one, Rav Yosef Karo's Psak did not reflect the minhagim already established. And number two, you are correct. What you're saying is also correct. There were poskim who came after the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush that should have been incorporated. Now, historically, the Rama and the Beis Yosef lived really the same time, so it's not like the Rama had access to later poskim, but the Rama did want to incorporate them because of that. Okay, so essentially, therefore, the Ashkenazic authorities that the Rama draws upon are primarily the Rush and the Balei HaTosfos that Beis Yosef lost, you know, that got dropped out because of the Beis Yosef's voting procedure. Having said that, it's important to know that Rav Yosef Karo was not fully consistent either. There were many, many, many times in which, if there were, let's say, the Rif and the Rambam held a certain way, but there was an overwhelming number of poskim that went the other way, he would deviate from his rule. His rule was not an ironclad rule, but it was a normal rule of assumption. By the way, the Rama had a lot of frustration. You know, the Beis Yosef was such a great work, because the Beis Yosef takes every halacha and gives you everything about it, from the Gemara all the way to the last poskim in his time. It's interesting that the Rama was working on an identical work. The Rama was working on an identical work on the Torah. And when he was almost finished, he got word that Rav Yosef Karo had printed his Beis Yosef. So as a result, the Rama's whole work was never printed. And he just reformulated it, because in addition to the Hagos on the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a briefer commentary on the Torah and the Beis Yosef that's called Darchei Moshe. So essentially, Darchei Moshe is a great, great abridgment of the original work the Rama wrote, which would have been duplicative of the Beis Yosef. So that's pretty frustrating when you spent years and years and years on this work, and then you discover somebody else just beat you to it. And yet the Rama went on, and the Rama, you know, managed to modify his work, so it became very, very important. The Rama died very young. The Rama died, I believe, at 48. And yet he was such a phenomenally great posek that Ashkenazic Jews still follow him. Rav Avadya Yosef always has this expression, said by Kriyas Yamsa, "Bnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Ramah." That means the Jewish people left with a high hand. They left with confidence. Now that's Resh Mem Hei. Ramah is Resh Mem Aleph. But he likes to say, "Achenu Ashkenazim are Bnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Ramah." They follow the hand of the Ramah.
Yeah. Just from the perspective of the Ramah, yep, to incorporate later poskim, what is it? I mean, there's an idea that the later generations had the ability to see a greater picture. And
yes,
so
yes. But remember, that's a principle called halacha kibasroi. The halacha is like the later. But, you know, we have to understand that. That doesn't mean, for example, I can argue on the Gemara because I'm later, so I have a greater perspective. The theory of halacha kibasroi is that the later authorities are able to see all of the arguments that were raised by everybody, and then they're able to decide it more. But that only applies, you understand, to later authorities that are essentially on the same madrega of Kedusha. So we might say later Rishonim might be more authoritative than earlier Rishonim. Later Amoraim might be more authoritative than earlier Amoraim. Later Tanoim might be more authoritative than earlier Tanoim, not because they're greater, the generations go down, but because they've seen more of the arguments. However, once you switch into a different tikufa, of course, who makes that? That's another good question. Meaning, in terms of an Amora arguing with a Tana, or a Rishon arguing with an Amora, or an Achron arguing with a Rishon, you do not say halacha kibasroi, because once the tikufos have ended, the level of holiness is so different and it's disintegrated so much that it can no longer count. Right? So you understand, halacha kibasroi, in some ways, is obviously a contradiction to the rule of niskatnu hadoros. The generations get worse as we go on, and it's only limited to people within that same general period of time. So it would encompass, for example, the Gedolim, the time of the Ramah, which are really the same time as the Beis Yosef. So then we could look at halacha kibasroi.
Do the written or oral Torah scribe somewhere how the Arabs will control all the oil? I've heard it said that it does.
Well, you know, listen, everything is in the Torah. Every single event is in the Torah. Now, I'm not subscribing necessarily to the Eshet Torah Bible codes, but even before the Bible codes and the encoding of messages, it is a Dover Pashat. Everything is in the Torah. And in point of fact, the Golden Gaon once said, everything that will ever happen is merumas in the first word of Bereshis. And he then said, it's merumas in the first letter of Bereshis. Beis. Right? So everything is in the Torah. Now, in the case of Yishmael, one of the things, when Yishmael was banished, one of the things that was said is that Yishmael will be given a blessing by Hashem. And it says, Yadol, he will be a wild person, uncontrollable. Para adam, wild, uncontrollable. You will not be able to rein him in. Yado bakol, his hand will be in everything. Viyad hakobo, and all will be against him as well. Now, his hand is in everything. That could mean a million things. But one of the things it could mean is that the entire world economy will be dependent on him. He will have a stranglehold over the world. Now, he who controls vast reserves of oil does have a great economic power over the world. Moreover, Islamic terrorism, which paralyzes the world and scares the world, right? This also means we can't do so many things. All those, now, granted, it may be relatively minor, but even the minor stuff you got to do at an airport today, because of September 11th and everything else. So I would say there's at least an indirect reference to the notion that the tentacles of Ishmael go going to spread in all sorts of areas, and that would support the idea of controlling oil. But a direct reference to oil, I am not aware of, oil per se, but the idea of controlling the world that we have there. By the way, Chazal talk about four exiles. What are the four exiles? This is not counting the tribe. I mean, exiles after we got to Israel. Four exiles that we go through. The first is Babylonia. The second is Persia. That's Haman. The third is Greece. And the fourth is Rome, called as Edom. And we are still in the exile of Edom, descended from Esau, because the Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and it hasn't yet been rebuilt. So the simple meaning is the fourth exile is Edom. But the Ibn Ezra actually says that the last exile before Mashiach comes will be the exile of Yishmael, not Esau, but Yishmael. And there is a medrash in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that says the last exile of the Jewish people before the coming of Mashiach is going to be the exile under Yishmael. Now, exile doesn't mean we're ruled by Yishmael directly, because we're not directly ruled by Yishmael, but Yishmael will subjugate us in a whole myriad of ways. And what the Medrash says is, this is an old Medrash, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, this is actually the oldest Medrash, says that the Golus of Yishmael is the most dangerous of all of the Goluses, because Yishmael is the only nation besides the Jewish people that has Hashem's name in their national identity. Aleph Lamed, Kael, we pronounce it, is Hashem's name. Yisrael, Yishmael. And what the Medrash is suggesting is that all the other Goliaths represent powers of materialism. And as devastating as that could be, the power of materialism can have no true ascendancy over Torah, which is spiritual. But Yishmael has a spiritual power. You might call it negative dark energy. Meaning to say, even though Yishmael might be using it in an evil way, but they have prayer, they have, you know, devotion to a cause, so to speak. It's hard for us to understand this, but it's hard for us to understand that prayer devoted to an immoral cause would have any power. But there is a concept that the koach of tefillah is so potent, they daven five times a day, that it can even help an evil person do things. It's hard to understand, but tefillah has that power that anyone that enlists it will be able to do things with it. And Yishmael has the koach of tefillah, getting it from Abraham. What does Yishmael even mean? Yishmael, God will listen. So as a result, Yishmael is an extraordinarily dangerous enemy because they have a certain spiritual power that Esau does not have. And the only way Yishmael can be defeated, therefore, is by intensifying our ruchnis, only by our tefillah. And that's why, in a sense, I think we've seen this. Any attempt to negotiate, to come to peace treaties, to wage war with the Arab nations, you know, nothing ever gets accomplished. Nothing ever gets accomplished. Whether we wage war or whether we try to talk peace, we always wind up not in a good place, because the political and military strategies don't work here. The only thing that works is Torah, Tefillah, and the Siras Nefesh. Because a ruchniyistika koach can only be combated by a ruchniyistika koach. And that's the danger of Yishmael. And so Yishmael not only has this control over the economy, but there's a negative, dark energy spiritual force that is present here as well, that one has to deal with.
Given that Islam only started in, I think, about 1400 years ago, roughly, can we really say that Yishmael always had the name of Hashem in it as well?
Well, obviously, historically it did, because it was Yishmael. Now the question is, what was Yishmael doing pre-Islam? That's a very, very good point. I don't even know. I'm assuming that pre-Islamic Bedouin society was pagan. Is that a correct assumption? So I think we would have to say the following. The way we would understand it is this. the spiritual power within them was latent until Muhammad. That was what I'm saying. Because it is implicit in their identity. But that's why it's no accident that B'nai Yishmael did not have a significant control of the world until the rise of Muhammad. So, in a sense, we could say it was precisely the turn to monotheism which unlocked that latent spirituality that was within them. So I think that's how we would answer. But look, you know, Muhammad wanted to become Jewish. That's why, you know, maybe we should have taken him. He was turned away because it was thought he was not a suitable candidate for conversion. So he went and did his own thing. But he hung around Jews a lot. He learned a lot of Midrashim, a lot of stories. He was very, he had a lively imagination, as the Quran can testify. And as a result, you know, a lot of stuff in the Quran, like, you know, corresponds to Midrashim, because when he was a camel driver for some Jewish merchants, he would listen to their stories and the like, and it stayed in his mind. Then he decided to go up on his own and do his own thing.
Yeah. It's often said that Avraham Avinu was first monotheist, and he was like the Chadesh monotheism, but what about Shankar Aver? What about Noah? What was everyone else doing?
Did you quote somebody who said Avraham was the first monotheist?
I didn't quote anyone in particular.
No. Clearly that's absolutely not the case. But I think what we could say about Avraham is Avraham was the first preacher of monotheism, in the sense that Shem V'Aver stayed where they were and did not actively engage in Kirov, did not try to bring other people over. If you came to them, they taught you that wisdom. In fact, Yaakov Avinu, years later, went to the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, although Shem was no longer alive. Aver is Shem's grandson. So I would not at all call Avraham Avinu the first monotheist, the first person who believed in one God. But he was undoubtedly the very first person who went out of his way to convince others and persuade others that there is one God, because he saw this as an expression of his love of Hashem, in the sense that if you truly love Hashem, you want to bring people to glorify Hashem, and that's what Avraham. So that's why he's called the first Jew, because the job of a Jew is not just to believe in Hashem, the job of a Jew is to help others come to believe in Hashem. So in that same way, he was the first one with a Jewish mission.
I recently heard that when people embarking Kiruv, like, or supporting Kiruv, they're sort of saving people's lives, but in terms of supporting religious Jews already, it's less of a concern because you're not doing the same kind of work.
Yeah.
Is that sort of a true statement, or is that?
Well, again, I think that comes from my advertising by the mayor, or Isha Torah, or whatever it is. As I said before, I know you worked it up with, you know, Kiruv Rechokim is a very, very important thing. Certainly, to bring the Shamos to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a tremendously important mitzvah. And one could characterize it as Pikuach Nefesh, saving people's lives in many, many ways. But the truth of the matter is, if you have poor Jews who need food to eat, then that's also saving their lives as well. So in short, I'm not going to give a psak, and I don't think anyone would give a psak that one type of tzedakah has absolute priority over the other. What I said to somebody before was, tzedakah is a strange mitzvah in the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves it to people to decide what causes appeal to their neshama. Every person is put into the world with a mission, and part of our mission is where we use our money. It's not our only mission, but you know, part of it is. And a person's neshama will feel that this is the mitzvah that I want to invest in. So for some people, it would be kolim for big Talmidei Chachamim. And for other people, it'll be kiruv rechokim. And for other people, it'll be helping poor kalos get married. For other people, it'll be hospitals to be, you know, for cholim and the like. And for other people, it'll be like the people who give to the art scroll shas to print Torah sword. Right? Now, all of these are needed. All of these are good. And I think each person needs to identify, not to the exclusion of others, you know, everyone should give something to everything. But where do you put your primary focus? I think each person makes their own decision as to what gives their neshama the greatest satisfaction. So there is a certain subjectivity in the allocation of stuff.
It's my understanding, and I may be completely off, that there were times that the Ramchal was on the run because of fears that Shabtai Tzvi had put into the Jewish people. At what point were his teachings, and why did they start to become accepted, his farm, things? When and why did they start to become accepted?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. Yeah, the run, he wasn't necessarily a fugitive, but just a few words just for everyone familiar. Shabtai Tzvi was a person known as one of the infamous false Moshiachs in around the 1600s. And to his defense, I'll give you a little defense, Shabtai Tzvi was probably mentally ill. He was not necessarily a Russia, but he was mentally ill. He was probably a paranoid schizophrenic, I mean that quite literally. And he was manipulated by the person who took the role of Eliyahu HaNavi, which is Nathan of Gaza, Nathan of Gaza. Probably convinced Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was actually a very gifted person. He was very charismatic. He was learned in Kabbalah, etc. But somehow he had a mental illness that people played upon that made him think he was Mashiach. And even though you might say, well, what's the big deal? I mean, there are people in Jerusalem today who say they're Mashiach. In fact, but the problem was, he wasn't just a guy who said he was Mashiach. The problem was tens of thousands of Jews followed him, and they were bankrupt. They gave up all their property to come to Eretz Yisrael, etc. And then what finally turned out was that the Sultan of the Turkish Empire that controlled Israel at the time imprisoned him as a revolutionary and forced him to convert to Islam, which he did. So when the person you think is Mashiach becomes a Muslim, that really shakes your faith tremendously. Now, there was a small group, and by the way, they say they're still around today, called the Dunma, who still believe that Shabtai Tzvi will come back, a kind of secret little cryptic group that still pray to him and the like. So, be it as it may, the problem with Shabtai Tzvi was that not only did it economically devastate huge numbers of Jews, but it destroyed their faith in Mashiach. They were broken, they were crushed, they thought that all of this is a joke, etc. Very, very serious, very, very, very devastating. But as a result of the Shabtai Tzvi, and part of his delusions were fueled by Kabbalah, in which he had mystical visions and meditations, there became like an anti-Kabbalah reaction that many Gedolim felt. Too many people who are not prepared are learning Kabbalah. This is leading them astray. This is giving them ideas they don't understand, they can't deal with. So there became kind of a notion of getting the Hamonah away from Kabbalah. Now in the next generation, you had a great person like Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. And Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato was from Italy, and then he lived in Amsterdam for a while. And the Ramchal, as you know, was a phenomenal Kabbalist at a very, very young age. We're talking about in his 20s already. And the Ramchal, there's actually a medical condition for this. He could write like 1,000 pages, and it's like you just write. He just wrote pages, and he had like a Ruach HaKodesh or a Malach, etc. And many of his Talmidim, he already had Talmidim as a very young person, you know, kind of looked at him as Mashiach. And they could call him. Well, you can obviously imagine in the generation after Shabtai Tzvi, they start talking about another guy as Mashiach. They have to crush him. So the Ramchal, who, by the way, also, I believe, never married, which added a certain, also, controversy to him. I don't want to say that for sure, but I believe that was the case. So the Ramchal was threatened with excommunication by the Rabbanim of Amsterdam. He was ordered to stop teaching Kabbalah, and he on his own burnt, because he didn't want other people to get his writings and use them or destroy them on their own. He burnt, they say, tens of thousands of pages of writings that never came to us. We have Rosh Hashem, we have quite a lot from the Ramchal, but he had tens of thousands of pages that he destroyed. What I think rehabilitated, I mean, the Ramchal didn't read rehabilitation, but what restored the Ramchal's reputation was the Vilna Gaon of the next generation. The Vilna Gaon said about the Mesilas Yesharim that if the Mechaber would have been alive, the Vilna Gaon says, I would walk barefoot from Vilna to Amsterdam to learn from the Ramchal. So the Vilna Gaon is imprimatur, that kind of restored the Ramchal's luster. And of course, that was only Basil Shishar, but eventually the other Svarim. The other Svarim really were not that popular in the Torah world till the age of the Musar movement. And the Musar yeshivas, they began to learn Derech Hashem, then eventually some of the Kabbalah Svarim as well. By the way, the Amsterdam Kehila was very tough on anything they regarded as deviant. The Ramchal was treated a little deviant. The other person, a little later, was the opposite direction. That was Spinoza. Spinoza was also a person in the Orthodox community of Amsterdam who became an apicurist. By the way, Spinoza, maybe it's a point of pride. Spinoza is a real apicurist. You know, most apicurists are not real apicurists. Most apicurists are ignorant. You know the story. People tell the story about a person who decided one day he wanted to be an apicurist. So they tell him, well, you got to talk to Yussel. Yussel is the apicurus of Minsk. So he looks in the universities, he looks in the libraries, he looks in the cafes. He figures that's where an apicurus hangs out. He says, no. You have to go to the Beis Medrash. That's where Yussel spends his whole day. So he goes to the Beis Medrash. He figures he'll see, you know, a free thinker smoking on Shabbos. No. Yussel is the man with the long white beard with the talus over his head wearing tefillin during the week. So it doesn't look like an apicurus. So he goes to Yussel and says, Yussel, you know, I don't believe in the Torah like you. I want to be an apicurus. I want to be part of your group. So Yussel looks at him and says, have you finished Shas? He says, well, no, I haven't finished Shas. Why should I finish Shas? Do you know Tanakh well? He says, no. So Yussel says, you don't know Shas, you don't know Tanakh. He says, you're no apicurus, you're just ignorant. And the truth of the matter is, that's a true statement. To be a real apicurus, you gotta know, and then reject, unfortunately. So, it's hardly a badge of honor, but actually Spinoza was a real apicurus. So Spinoza was someone who had learned Torah, and Spinoza rejected. In fact, it's amazing, Spinoza was the first philosopher since Matan Torah, Jew, Christian, or Islam, who rejected the divinity. I mean, it's amazing. People don't realize what a path-breaking philosopher he was. That's why he's called the father of modern philosophy. He was the first philosopher to openly reject the divinity of the Torah. He was in Amsterdam, in the generation after the Ramchal, and he was excommunicated not because they thought he was Mashiach, but because he was an apicurus and the like. So what I'm saying is Amsterdam was tough on both ends of the spectrum. If you were too Kabbalistic or Messianic, or you were leaving the religion of the Torah, they excommunicated you. And this is a kind of a dark, spooky ceremony. At least Spinoza's excommunication. It was the middle of the night. Everybody was dressed in black. And they used 400 shofars. It was a very, very like eerie, scary type of ceremony. For the Ramchal, I don't think the Ramchal was excommunicated. He was threatened with it if he didn't give up teaching of Kabbalah. And that's why he destroyed a lot of his swear.
Yeah. I don't know if the room is aware of the situation in South Africa at the moment, but Rabbi Eliezer Berlin has taken refuge in South Africa with about 300 of his followers. So I was
Rabbi Eliezer who?
Rabbi Eliezer Berlin.
You mean the breastfeeder?
Yeah.
Why did he leave Eretz Israel?
Because there
are
some serious charges.
Oh, sexual abuse or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Of rape.
Okay.
And I was wondering what the halakhic obligation of the South African Jewish community is to number one, support or harbor him, considering that he's wanted for crimes, and number two, to support his followers.
Well, that's a very hard question. Now, in a way, had it been in a reverse situation, it might have been a little easier to answer. Let's assume somebody was accused of a crime in Chutz Laaretz and sought refuge in Eretz Yisrael, which was often the case in the life. So there are good halakhic bases that you don't extradite a Jew from Eretz Yisrael to face prosecution in Chutz Laaretz. Now, other views say you do. Other views say you do, but at least there is a concept of Eretz Yisrael being a haven. And this is derived indirectly from the principle that if an Eved runs away from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael, he is not delivered back to his master. Of course, his master could move to Israel and then take him as an Eved, but we don't extradite people out of Eretz Yisrael. But this is a reverse situation. Here you're talking about a situation where he is accused of something in Eretz Yisrael and has left Eretz Yisrael. I would say, well, in a sense, it depends on how you view the state of Israel. It all depends. If you view the state of Israel as a Jewish state that was established with the Ratzon of Hashem, then it would actually be proper that he go back to the Jewish state because the Jews are going to judge him and decide. If you consider the state of Eretz Yisrael to be corrupt and anti-Torah, then in a sense it would be wrong to give him over. The question about his supporters, well, I mean, they're Jews. You know, once again, the only question is, if it's wrong for him to seek refuge, then you shouldn't support the supporters who are giving him refuge in that case. He established his own show, right? I assume he's not integrated in the regular community. Is their own thing?
They're thinking about starting a show, but they were actually, they have integrated into the starting part of the community.
And are people are welcoming them, or they're not, they don't know? They don't know what to do.
There was like a letter sent out, not to give support.
Yeah.
Because we didn't want to be viewed as harboring actual fugitives. But then before Pesach, another sort of thing was set up that we can't have Jews on the street for Pesach, so support them for Pesach, and then after Pesach.
I think the short answer basically is you give them the physical. In other words, there's a distinction between supporting people and harboring people. I think it would be wrong to harbor them. It would be wrong to conceal them. It would be wrong to prevent the government from doing what it needs to do. But since people are innocent until proven guilty, there's no reason why we shouldn't give them food, shelter, and access to religious services. So you see, there's a difference between that type of support and hiding them. I would not be in favor of hiding him, because that's an evasion of justice. But as long as they're there, we should take care of them. Not abandon them. So that would be appropriate.
I was wondering what the Rav held on buffering, maybe especially for snap buffering, while he was having Facebook or non-kosher folks.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, everything Hashem makes in the world has a utility. You know, Facebook has positive benefits. Non-kosher phones have positive benefits in terms of access to things that a person might need. But like everything else, you know, there is good and bad. And a person has to look at the fact that even something that has many, many positive uses has such a potential for devastation that it's much, much better. You just have to avoid it. In other words, I'll give up some of the benefits because the potential harm is very, very great. So I would think that one should really try to avoid the use of social media because there are so many ways it can trap you. At a minimum, it traps you in a waste of time. And the waste of time is tremendous, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, all of that stuff. But then it also exposes you to lack of tznius, immoral pictures, immoral content, and the like. So I know that some Kirov organizations, I don't think Rishmash does it, but some they actually use Facebook to publicize events and communicate. So the judgment has to be made. If this is how we reach people, this is how we reach people. But I think it leaves an unpleasant taste in my mouth that we have to use those types of things. But even if the organization does it to reach out to people, that doesn't translate in you as an individual using it. Because, you know, for you, you don't have that same imperative and that same justification. So I would try to avoid it. A non-kosher phone is really the same thing, if not even worse. I mean, if by a non-kosher phone you mean a phone with unlimited internet access, you know, you see what the problem is. Now, I'm not going to go as far as the wall posters that say anyone that has an iPhone doesn't have a share in all of our books. By the way, that's, to be a little irreverent, that would be a solution to the Aguna crisis, at least for modern Agunas. You know, well, one of the big problems in Klal Yisrael is there are women whose husbands refuse to give them a get. And they're stranded. These women are stranded. Her husband doesn't give her a get. What can you do? But now we can come along and say that their marriages were not valid to begin with because the rabbis who were Edom may have had an iPhone. So you understand the idea. If the marriage is invalid, you don't need a get. So I guess anyone who gets married after, I don't know, 2005, whenever the iPhone came out, no Laguna problems. Rosh Hashanah, that's no marriages are valid after that day. So maybe that'll be a solution, right? So I'm not going to tell you that, but I am going to tell you that particularly a bracha, once you're married, you have business, right? So you may need things for business and the like. So I'm not going to tell you no. But if you're a bachur and it's not something you really need, I think you have to ask yourself, is this going to enable me to be closer to Hashem? Or is this going to take me further from Hashem? And that's really the question. If you conclude, now you might, it's theoretically possible to conclude that my access to these shiurim on the internet is really so powerful. Maybe you'll come to that conclusion. But I think most of the time your answer is going to be no. And if the answer is going to be no, then why have it? What does it do? What does it do? Right? So that's kind of how you look at it. Anything else? Okay, you all be well and have a good Shabbos. You guys have a